Good evening. My name is Travis Mabel, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the departments of biology and psychology, I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, Natural Selection and War. Many scholars and influential military figures have analyzed war in an attempt to define it. However, one question has not received the attention it deserves. What are the biological reasons for war? New advances in genetics and evolutionary biology have provided us with new perspectives on this important question. In conjunction with Darwin's theory of natural selection, these new perspectives might enable us to make significant contributions to the understanding of the biological underpinnings of war. Tonight's speaker, Colonel Paul B. Olson, an Army Corps of Engineers officer, is the author of The Nature of War Theory. He has attended the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College and the U.S. Army War College, where he graduated with honors. He has been awarded the Bronze Star Medal and the Meritorious Service Medal with four oak leaf clusters. In 2003, he was the recipient of the Secretary of the Army's Frank Pace Award for Innovation and the 2011 recipient of the Commandant's Award for Distinction in Research at the U.S. Army War College. At this time, please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. A question and answer session will follow the lecture, so please hold your questions until then. And now please join me in welcoming Colonel Paul B. Olson.
Thanks, Travis, for that generous introduction. Makes me sure wish my wife was here to hear that one, because she wouldn't have believed it when I tell her what you said about me. I'd also like to point out that she is my inspiration to another colonel serving our nation in the United States Army. Her duties kept her at the Pentagon this evening. Dr. Pullman, Dr. Weissman, Dr. Pyers, Dr. Henson, Dr. Crane, and Dr. Williams, thank you for your presence here. The fact that you represent the multidisciplinary approach that our education system has is truly impressive, and I believe that you'll find points of this nature of war theory that bear on your academic studies. Before I start, I would love to get a sense of this audience tonight, because this is a multidisciplinary topic. So I'm going to ask for a little bit of a poll here, and I would like to see hands up, if you will, of all the historians in the room. Who claims to be a historian? Okay, a couple. Military historians. Okay. How about military? Any military in the room? Okay, I have a few. Great. Great to see that. Social sciences. Where are the social? Okay. Ouch. Traditional sciences. Where are the hard scientists? Excellent. That means the rest of you are poets and lovers, right? And that's good, because I'm a poet and lover too, and in this presentation I'll be throwing a lot of art in there and maybe some quotes from literature, because sometimes I think artists and poets get it right before we scientists do. But it's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be at Dickinson. It's an honor to be back in Dickinson. Although I was never enrolled in this university, I spent more hours in the fourth floor of your library in the stacks in the southeast corner reading about this stuff. Yeah, I think I've seen some of you guys up there too last year, so that's good. But it's a great academic place, a great academic environment, and a faculty that reached out and assisted me and made this possible, along with also the faculty from the U.S. Army War College and their fantastic library, and that library which pulled a lot of this research. In a recent article, Thomas Friedman, author of the book The World is Flat, said there's something happening here. And if you look at the pictures that I've displayed, the events in the Middle East, the Occupy Wall Street situation, you must admit there truly is something happening here. And that's what the nature of this presentation is going to try to frame for us together in a multidisciplinary approach. So as a military man, I need a plan of attack. So this is what I'm proposing to talk about this evening. Start with a scientist's thoughts on military theory. I took a little biology as a graduate school and as graduate student, and learned from some of the great readings I did in that phase of my life. And then there's a soldier's thought on natural selection. I've been in the Army for 23 years, and it's been a tough time of service. But over that time, I've made sure I've carved out sufficient time to research areas that I found particularly interesting, and natural selection is definitely one of those. Then I'm going to try to merge those together in what I call a nature of war theory. a theory of framework that takes military theory and natural selection and puts them into a common framework. I'll then present something called a sacrifice ratio, which I feel might be a predictor of future wars. Conclude it. I'd love to hear from your questions and then close it with some final thoughts. So let's start first with a scientist's thoughts on military theory. And if you're a fan of The Far Side like Gary Larson, you see that it's a scientific joke there showing various evolutionary traits of man, and the last one with Jazz Man holding his bass guitar. But when it comes for war, I'd like to begin our discussion with retracing some history and going back to one of the times when theories of war were rapidly being developed in our world, and that's the 19th century. It was an age of positivism, which things were trying to be described scientifically through a framework. I needed a framework in which to examine theories of war and theories of natural selection in a like framework. And I found the writings of Auguste Comte, who was the leader of the positivistic movement, to be quite suitable for this. In the 19th century, positivism by Auguste Comte was based on this inverted pyramid here, which Comte argued that you could not have one science fully evaluated until the science below it was evaluated. So he described first astronomy, which was a term for mathematics, that once you understand math, you can then understand physics. You can't understand chemistry until you have a complete understanding of physics. Again, you cannot understand biology until you have your mind around the chemistry of the situation. And at the top of his inverted pyramid was sociology, the youngest science of the time, which he argued you could not understand unless you understood the subordinate sciences underneath. That was the current thinking of the time of scientists. What was the current thinking of the time for military? It was very different. The military was really trying to determine what war actually was. They knew a lot about warfare, how to do it, but they didn't know what war was, and they really struggled with some definitions. A name you might recall, Sun Tzu, in his work, The Art of War, used this as a definition. Another military great, Thucydides, from the Greeks, simply characterized war as being driven by fear, honor, and interest. Some would translate it as profit. Hobbes, an Englishman, said war is a natural consequence of societal appetites. Interesting. Two that are taught at the War College, Jomini and Machiavelli, did not bother to define war in their theories. They just accepted that it existed. And then the granddaddy of them all taught at the War College, Karl von Clausewitz, who we pull a lot from in Western armies, gave a definition of war that's pretty much followed at the War College today. But we didn't have a true definition of what war was. But I took a look at these definitions through the eyes of not a military, not as a soldier, but a naturalist. I found something very interesting. If you look at those definitions that were very vague, and you concentrate on the underlying words, what you see is a lot of biology in there, natural selection. These gentlemen could not get their mind around what war was, I subscribe to you, because they didn't have the proper framework to understand what they were looking at. So you really can't blame them for not understanding what war actually was, because they did not yet have the defining moment, which I characterize as Charles Darwin and his Voyage of the Beagle, which is roughly, as you see, the same time that the great theorists of war, Jomini, Machiavelli, and Clausewitz, were developing their theories. So bottom line, what I mean by this is these great minds did not have the idea of natural selection in the development of their theories of war. Recalling Comte's hierarchy, his reverse pyramid, where he argued that math drives physics, drives chemistry, drives the life science, drives the social sciences, prior to Darwin, they thought they had it right. They thought they had figured out all there was to figure out of biology, and there's even writing that said that biology was a completed science. So why not go right to social science? But then Darwin came up with his theory of natural selection, and I submit to you that Comte's hierarchy actually looked like this, where the life sciences were not as big as they thought they were because natural selection wasn't included, and because natural selection wasn't understood, the social sciences were incomplete. Ergo, you had incomplete theories of war. Fast forwarding over to the War College of today, we spend a lot of time reading, about 300 pages a night, reading about military history, economic theories, everything that goes along the lines of global and national strategy. I've listed up here a number of the theories of war that we spend a lot of time studying. At the bottom, you see many of the classics that I pointed out. Here's Clausewitz and his famous book on war, Yomini, Art of War, Machiavelli, Art of War, Sun Tzu, Art of War, and Thucydides, The History of the Peloponnesian War. These are the classics, and they do well to cover what we consider regular warfare, war as you see in the movies. However, there's a new strain of theories that's also taught in the War College, and those are the theories that do well to cover irregular warfare. Those include David Galula, Counterinsurgency Warfare, Mao on Guerrilla Warfare, General Petraeus and his coin manual, and Colonel Trinquier and Modern Warfare. These are the two camps of doctrine. We are joined with us today by Dr. Conrad Clayne Crane from the U.S. Army War College, and what Con would be too humble to tell you is that he was the lead author, one of the three lead authors on this book. And it's a real privilege to have Dr. Crane with us this evening. What this book did for turning around the insurgency, counterinsurgency in Iraq and is truly inspirational for our nation. And I, for one, would like to give you a round of applause. So that's where I stand on this argument. I'm kind of in the camp on the upper side, on the counterinsurgency side of the camp, in full disclosure. And joining me is another one of my advisors, Colonel and Dr. Tom Williams, who advised me on this research, who's done fantastic work on the psychological aspects of warfare. And Dr. Williams, I'd argue that you're one of us. You can get behind the line if you want, but you helped me way too much, so you're now one of us. And of course, you saw all those great picture people with the frames because they're important. So Dr. Crane, there's your frame for you. That's how much esteem I hold you in there. Okay, so now let's enter. Let me back up a second. So as you see, the black line is significant here. We were talking about this at dinner. The two camps generally don't mix at the War College and in our Army too well. There are those who know every word of every page and every chapter on war and all the great classics, and they think they got it right, okay? And then at the War College, there's also a bunch of us who feel that, yeah, you have some it right, but this is right too. The two group, this line is very symbolic. They don't mix too well together, and this is a rift that exists in our military today. And you can see that for you poli-sci majors in some of the discussions on national strategy. Is it better to go for nation building, like the top would advocate, or is it better to go for counterterrorism, like the bottom would advocate? This is a very significant problem in our military, reconciliation. But again, why don't we try something different? If you insert Charles Darwin into this equation, I will show you that there are some connections in between the theories of the top and the theories of the bottom. If you include natural selection in Comte's inverted pyramid and stretch out your social sciences, you will see some connections in human and group behavior between what's going on here and what's going on here, where he could conceivably serve as the missing link that binds these competing theories of war into one overarching theory of war. This is not a new idea. This was tried right after World War I, the war to end all wars, millions killed, by two august individuals at the time, a gentleman named Quincy Wright, who did a study of war, which I would bring with you, but it's like this thick. It's huge. And another individual, not as well known, called Major General J.F.C. Fuller, who looked at this idea, okay, let's take this new idea of Darwin in the post-World War I area and make sure that war never happens again. Let's figure out what's going on here. It's unfortunate, though, that their work was rejected, because when you actually pick apart natural selection, the early version of natural selection that they were using concentrated on individuals and individuals evolving, which we'll talk about later, but it did not work as an overarching theory of war. So this idea of natural selection did exist after World War I. Dr. Crane and I were talking about it, but it was largely discredited till this day. So what did that do? That put us right back to where we started from. We still have the camp up top and the camp up down the bottom that are competing theories of war. Next section, I want to talk a little bit of the soldiers' thoughts on natural selection. And I think if you ask most soldiers these questions, that's what they'll think, why the dinosaurs actually went extinct. If you can't read that, it says the real reason why dinosaurs became extinct, and they're not being the nicest dinosaurs there. So to talk about natural selection, you must have a little bit of knowledge on Darwin and what he was postulating with the theory of natural selection. The first being is natural selection happens at the individual level. He used an example called the Galapagos finch to illustrate this, if you saw that, this is an early variant of this bird, the Galapagos finch, who over time you had genes that mutated that allowed these finches' beaks to get smaller and smaller over time. A Galapagos finch with a smaller beak is allowed to get seeds, this beak, more efficiently than this beak. So the bird who's got the smaller beak is going to eat more. If he eats more, he's going to reproduce more. His fitness will go up, which means his ability to reproduce will go up. And over time, those finches with these genes that create the smaller beak will become dominant over the beaks with the biggest the finches with the bigger beaks. Other examples of this are the panda bears, who evolved a thumb in order to allow them to strip their leaves off for their diet easier off the branches. The early bears that had the genetic mutation of having a white gene in their fur versus a brown or a black, and therefore were able to hunt better in the Arctic. Those mutations were able to succeed better over time. Those bears would eat more. Their fitness would go up. That's the very basic explanation for individual reproduction, individual evolution. And the one that was pretty much the leading theory of natural selection up until very recently. Of course, if you let these birds keep on evolving over time, you will have our friends here, which I think you're all aware of. Those are the angry birds if you're up with your iPads. But there's something else going on here with this individual selection. There's something else at play that Darwin himself had a hard time getting his mind around. And you have to read this passage and this paragraph in his Origin of Species several times to really understand what he's saying. But in a nutshell, he gets the fact that individuals are evolving and these positive genes are mutating, and when you have a mutation that benefits the species, that organization will advance. But what Darwin is trying to figure out is this idea that although individuals evolve, there is a certain benefit that happens when groups work together. And that there is really no individual advantage of being a team player. So there's got to be something else at work here. It's an interesting idea, and the best example I can come up with is an example in natural selection that's well-researched by an individual named Packard, and he looks at lions. Now, being a Packers fan, if you say Packers-Lions, that means something different to me. But let's take a look at what Packard wrote about lions. He said if you took a pride of lions and you looked at the best hunters in that group, those hunters who were the best at what they did would eat more, and if they ate more, they would be healthier, and if they're healthier, they would reproduce more, and those types of lions that had the genes that made them good hunters would continue. That's individual level selection. That's survival of the fittest, if you will. But what about if you've got another pride of lions on the savannah right there? That's not as good as not as good at hunting lions as the pride that you're looking at. What do they have to do? They can either wait it out and continually be outcompeted on the Serengeti hunting for food, and if that happens, they go extinct, right? So they have to do something different. They have to adapt. So there really is a couple choices there. They either have to become better hunters themselves to outcompete, or maybe they do something different and they say, hunting's important, but we need to become better fighters. So this pride of lions has an aggressive streak that attacks the first pride, and that way those two groups at the group level are evolving with each other. But wait, there's more. That one's pretty easy to explain. But what about when you have a group of lions that are the best hunters, that are the best fighters? There are still going to be groups, individuals within that group that don't hunt and don't fight. It's the same with almost every social species, that once you have a perfectly balanced group that is sustainable and doing everything right, in nature you're going to have within the population of this social group individuals that don't hunt and don't fight. They're shirkers. Now, if you think about this from a reproductive standpoint, the logic doesn't make sense here. Because if you're constantly putting yourself on the line and hunting and fighting for your pride, over time, statistics are going to catch up with you and you're going to get hurt. And it's not a good idea to be a hurt lion and, you know, trying to survive in Africa. Whereas your friends who aren't hunting, they're loafing, they're shirking, they're the ones that are reproducing more. So natural selection would argue that you do not want, that you cannot have these lazy genes reproducing more because your population will not adapt. So that's the idea of this multi-level selection. That's three examples of one pride of lions where you have evolution happening at the individual level, between the groups, and among the groups. We'll tie this all in together shortly. Okay, I just described to you the line between the two competing theories of war. And what do you know? That same line, and you biologists would probably agree with me, exists. There are two competing camps of natural selection. And I'll tell you, it's an exciting time to be a strategist, and it's an exciting time to be a environmental biologist, because these guys are going at it with each other. But they use words, which is a lot better than anything else. But their articles are pretty intense. So on the bottom here, you have those who don't subscribe to that there's anything happening at the group level. They think that it is mainly at the individual level, and that individual level evolution per Darwin is all you need to explain natural selection. So what we have is Dr. Trivers, Dr. Williams, and Dr. Gould here, three very renowned biologists, environmental biologists. Up top, you have a new breed of thoughts that's led by Dr. E.O. Wilson, his associate, Dr. Wilson, and a few others that come up with this idea that, no, it's not just individual level selection. It's natural selection happens at multiple levels. And this idea is gaining steam. It's being written about, but it is still controversial. So within this controversy, there's Dr. Pyers there. I'll put him up there. What do you think, Tony? Would you agree with that? Are you with me? Okay. And then, of course, I'm a Packer fan. I got to throw that up there, too. I subscribe to this, too. Okay? But the point is, it's just as there's this cat fight going on in the military theories, there's the same cat fight going on in the scientific theories. So being in a position where I'm looking at these two fights going on, these two disagreements, and being a naturally curious person, I am, I tried to pull these together in what I called a nature of war theory. So remember, second attempt, this has been tried once before and been discredited. So it's not a new idea, but a former associate of mine used to say, if you want a good idea, look in an old book. And so this idea has been in old books, but now we're approaching it differently. We're not just taking a look at the ideas of Fuller and Quincy Wright, but we're incorporating the ideas of E.O. Wilson with the group evolution, multi-level evolution, Gould and Associates with the individual evolution associates, taking our classic irregular theorists, pulling in our tried and true traditional guys, putting a little Darwin, and trying to come up with a nature of war theory. Okay, I'm an engineer, so I like Venn diagrams. So this is the one I came up with. If you have your theories of natural selection on your left side, and your theories of war on your right side, and across the bottom, you have individualistic theories, think the lions that are survival of the fittest lions, altruistic adaptations, think groups against groups and multi-level selection, happening in the natural world. You come on this side and you have individualistic war, which is war based on individual needs and desires. I'll explain that in a little bit. And altruistic war, which is war that's for the good of the group. And you lay out the thinkers. Here you have your individualists, your multi-level natural selectionists. Here you have your individual, your classic theorists. Here you have your altruistic war theorists. And here you have Fuller and Wright, who've had a step into this overlap area, along with E.O. Wilson and Wilson. You get an overlap between the two theories that have many of the same insights. And those insights I tried to pull together in a nature of war theory, which I'll introduce to you with some examples. Oh, there we go. There's Dr. Crane there. I'll put him right with General Petraeus. There's Tony up there. And let's see here. Yeah, and that's where I templated my advisor there. I thought to get a kick out of this. Too late to put one in the middle, but I wanted to Google a picture of Sheldon Cooper because I put him right there. And if you're a fan of the Big Bang Theory, you know he knows everything. So he'd be right there. Finally got a laugh out of you guys. I mean, it's a tough crowd. Okay. Okay, the first thing is I had to come up with a new definition of war. Bottom line, what this said is war is a phenomena that's driven by natural selection. Natural selection is the biological underpinning of war. Natural selection is the fuel that's forcing the behaviors of human groups or the behaviors of any social species to go to war. Those behaviors generally fall into two categories. One being individualistic. Think about the finches. Think about the lions who are survival of the fittest, looking out for themselves, if you will. That's a little anthropomorphic. And the other force is the altruistic, those who are sacrificing themselves for the good of the group. These are the two competing behaviors that are ongoing in natural selection, according to Wilson and company. So let's talk about these individualistic forces. These are forces that are originating from the primacy of individual-level adaptions in a society over altruistic adaptions. I used a piece of art here, which is very emotional. It's Cinco de Mayo by Goya, which displays the Spanish combating the French in an insurgency during the Napoleonic era. Here you see a group of individuals. Here you see another group of individuals. The way that this action is being brought out, if you've got a bunch of soldiers, that the way they're waging war is to have a firing squad on another group represented by those individuals. This group represents the intentions of Imperial France. This group represents the intentions of the population in Spain at the time. Primacy of individual level adaptations. They're doing something that is not for the good of the group. The other force is the altruistic force. Here's a picture of Fidel Castro and Che Guevara representing the uprising in Cuba. This is violent conflicts that originate from a privacy of group-level adaptations. Ultimately, individuals within a group will rise up and combat because the adaptations getting taken from them by another group, they've had it. They've had too much. They must rise up, and that's another force where war can get originated from. Primacy of group-level adaptations. Therefore, if you take a look at war at the most fundamental level, war is a conflict that originates from a literal tug of war between two evolutionary forces at play, individualistic adaptation represented by one group, and altruistic adaptations represented by another group. I'll go into some more detail on this. In this picture, you see a shot of the French Revolution. Here you see some soldiers of the Bourbon Society, the royalty, combating French citizens at the in Paris. Okay. I presented earlier that war was a combination of altruistic forces and individual forces. If you lay those against each other, if you lay those forces against each other in a quad, you see a very, what I think is a very interesting and telling relationship. Here's one force, individual forces all the way to altruistic on one side, individual on this side. The other group, individualistic here, altruistic here. In this quad up here, you have individualistic against individualistic. These are two states or two groups that are combating each other for something that is not necessarily for the good of the group. Maybe it's a desire, maybe it's a strategy, maybe it's a principle, maybe it's something. I put a picture of Operation Desert Storm up there to show, to typify what this type of war looks like. It's usually fixed armies going at it head-to-head, standing armies. Neither of them really have a vital national interest in place, yet the war still happens, arguably, and is not for the good of the group. These are the wars we must be very cautious of. On the other side is another interesting version of war, which is when two sides are both altruistic. I argue that these are the bloodiest of all the wars. This is brother against brother. This is family against family. If you happen to be on combating sides of two altruistic groups, that means you are both fighting for your evolutionary primacy, and both of those are for the good of the group. This is where it gets interesting. Oh, I'm sorry. And these are typified by being regular wars, which we in the Army called symmetrical. Generally, both sides kind of look the same. But if you take them and develop asymmetric or irregular warfare, up here you have an example of individualistic forces and altruistic forces fighting each other. This is a picture of revolutionary France, which I've talked before, where the altruism of the French rose up against the individualism of the Bourbon Empire. You had a revolution. The opposite can be happening when you have individualistic forces countering against altruistic needs. Then you have forces coming in, changing the political and social landscapes through something called counterinsurgency, which allows an individual desire to fall over what might be a current altruistic group. Those different forces drive different theories. When you have regular war, the classics work pretty well when you have symmetric war, because both sides are understandable. Both sides have generally the same biological driver, and both behaviors can be generally the same and can be predictable. But that only works when the evolutionary wars are symmetrical. When they're not symmetrical, we've seen through experience that the classics do not apply. They did not apply well in Iraq initially. They did not apply well in Afghanistan. They did not apply well in Vietnam. Why is that? I argue that those are the asymmetric wars, and you have to have a different way of looking at things. When you have an individualistic group trying to counter the wills of a population, you have a counterinsurgency going on. With that, you need a doctrine authored by General Petraeus and Conrad Crane that identifies the need to win over the population for truly what's best for them. And there's David Galula, who did the same research for French Algeria. On the opposite side of the spectrum, you have a situation where you might have a group rising up that is for the good of the group, combating an individualistic adaptation that's not right. Here you have Mao Zedong, who led the People's Revolution in China. And here you have Thomas Paine, who developed you could call it a theory of war, but really it's a political theory of the wealth of nations, of why it's essential for the United States to rise up against the privations that were submitted by England. So different theories. And of course, you also in these four quads will find different behaviors. Individualistic against individualistic, that's a piece of art from the Crimean War, the Charge of the Light Brigade. Ours is not to reason why, ours is but to do and die. Into the Valley of Death rode the 600. Why? What were they fighting for? They were fighting for individual adaptations of their two competing states at the time. Here, right near where we're staying right now, is General Armistead leading the last of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. Brother against brother, forces against forces. Both armies truly believed what they were doing was for the good of the group, altruism. And that's what brought those men in Pickett's charge to drive up that hill into the withering fire on the third day of Gettysburg. We already talked about the individualistic against altruistic. The behavior would have driven those soldiers to fire on those civilians because that was the only way they thought they could win that war. And this is one of my favorite pictures and one of my favorite memories from my time when I was in college was the individual in Tiananmen Square who had the behavior that enough was enough and he was going to stand in front of those Chinese tanks and not let those privations continue to happen on his group in Tiananmen Square. One also can see examples of this in history in famous speeches like Patrick Henry, where he says, I know not what others may choose, but for I, give me liberty or give me death. What causes someone to make that statement? What causes that man to stand in front of those tanks? Quick little summary we'll go through to drive this point home. A few slides on this topic covering the French Revolution. Very, very cursory, very basic example. Here you have the Bourbon royalty. He's looking like he's eating pretty well. He's looking like he's dressing pretty well. He's looking like he's living the high life. Wouldn't you agree? Okay. And here on the other side you have a little Cosette, I think her name is, from Les Miserables. I know I was kind of going for a little sensitivity there. But she did kind of represent the French people at the time. Victor Hugo was right. It was pretty miserable times. And Charles Dickens had it right, too, with the Tales of Two Cities. It was the best of times for these. It was the worst of times for those. Ultimately, we have Queen Marie Antoinette here, that when the French came with a simple request, we want bread, what did Marie Antoinette say? Yeah, let them eat cake. How do you think that worked out over for them, okay? The point happened then where the good of the group had to overcome what was going on from the good of a smaller group of individuals. Armies were stood up. You had the individualistic forces, which are usually well-trained and equipped, and they work for that head of state, if you will, royalty in this case. And you have the altruistic force, which, you know, they're not as well-trained and equipped, but they've got a lot of spirit on their side. They're adapting, because if they don't adapt, they go extinct, as Darwin would say. This, of course, leads to revolution. And one of my favorite pictures in the Louvre by Delacroix shows the spirit of the French Revolution. And I'll tell you, I got a little too passionate on this slide. And two people have pointed out that this is the 1830 Revolution, not the earlier French Revolution. But I still love this painting. And I still think it gets it right for a number of reasons. Because it shows what an altruistic army looks like. It shows the spirit. It shows, you know, you don't even see the government forces happening because this evolution, this adaption, this group level evolution is truly for the good of the group, and it could not be stopped. An interesting conversation Dr. Henson and I were having was this is a neat shot, too, because if you look at the Dickinson crest, not the new one here, the old one, apparently it's got the Liberty cap on it, which this gentleman is wearing right here. The red Liberty cap. So that sense you can see of that this stuff being important transcends into whoever thought about putting that into your own school crest. Kind of makes that connection saying, you know, I don't really know what this whole vibe is, but I like it, and it's important. And you know what? The Army picked up on that too. If you haven't seen the crest of the Army, look right there. You know what that is? Yeah, that's the same red Freedom hat that's in the symbol of the United States Army, which is also the symbol of the revolutionary France. Okay, the sacrifice ratio. That's all well and good. But can we put it into math, and can we therefore predict war? I say we can. I'm going to submit that idea to you right now. We have to go to the most basic example to start with, and then I'll take it up a little bit. But we are the individuals that I had lunch with picked up on this, and it's the floating slime mat. I think that's what we called it. But really what it is, it's a culture of this bacteria called, and help me out here, Pseudomonas fluorescens, which has one charge in life. They have to float or they're going to die. Here is a healthy culture of these floating bacteria doing what they should. And here's an unhealthy one that sank. What they should be doing is the bacteria should be making this adhesive. That when you make this adhesive, it's buoyant. And if you make enough of it, it floats. Now remember the lions that I talked to you about before? There were some lazy lions, some shirking lions. And I said this happens a lot in nature. It also happens with our floating slime mat. There are shirker cells in there that they decide they don't, well, this is getting anthropomorphic again, but they're not making as much adhesive as they need to. And when they don't make enough adhesive or are lazy, what happens to the culture? It dies. It sinks. Okay? So now think about if you're a good scientist and you got really small tweezers and you can separate the bacteria that are working hard and making the adhesive from the ones that are not, and you put that on your little bitty scale and you weigh it, in that case, you can get a precise number of what that sacrifice ratio is for this little simple example. Okay, so here they are. Here's our lazy bacteria just hanging out, reproducing. Here's our worker ones. They're reproducing their floating mat to keep them floating. Here's the sacrifice ratio there. Once that line is met, once it's crossed over, well, right now it's okay. You've got some distance. They're not a lot of shirkers here, so they're backed off a bit from the sacrifice ratio. So that culture is floating. It's surviving. Okay? Now, what happens if these guys start taking advantage of the group, taking too many individualistic privations, if you will, take too many advantages from the group, and that sacrifice ratio is met? That culture sinks, that culture's over, that culture's extinct. Very basic example. But you can apply that to lions. If these were the slacker lions and these were the hunting lions, you can only support so many slackers. If you've got too many slackers, that pride is going to fail. You can make the connection too to human societies. When you have too many individuals that are not behaving altruistically for the good of the group, and too many individuals taking individual advantages, strategic ecology would say that's not sustainable. Okay, so then let's go back to some examples I talked about earlier before. Here's our French Revolution. You've got Cosette here, who can only take so much. The Bourbon Empire went right up to the limit, and once it hit that sacrifice limit, boom, war. In this example, a regular warfare, you've got individualistic against altruistic. Next example, let's flip that one. Another irregular war example that we know well, the American Revolution. Here you have an American soldier or American revolutionist dressed up like a Native American throwing tea into the Boston Harbor, right? That was a... And here you have a soldier of the British Army, very fixed, very regular. The British Army had a sacrifice ratio. They could only take so much of this adaption. After it got to one point, the speeches of Patrick Henry, the Declaration of Independence come to bear. This turns into another type of irregular warfare, which is of altruistic primacy, yet results in war nonetheless. Individualistic against individualistic, symmetric, if you will, regular. Here you have a tank from Saddam Hussein's army in the first Gulf War. Looking at a tank from our army, 1991. Sacrifice ratio about in the middle. Both sides met it. You have the Battle of 73 Easting, tank on tank, and war erupts. But again, the drivers here were the needs of the Iraqis. They wanted their oil fields in Kuwait that they thought were theirs, and they thought that was worth it. Would they have failed without it? I don't think so. And here's the Americans leading a coalition who said, no, you can't do that. We're going to fight you on these because we need our oil too. But really, were either of these countries facing an existential issue where they had to go to war? Or really, was it individual level adaptations. We want this. And the third one I talked about, the wars of choice. These were the bloodiest ones, the toughest ones, where both sides are exerting altruism. They both feel, their behaviors are grounded in something that's for the good of the group. Once those sacrifice ratios are there, that's when you have war. Okay, so let me go back to the initial kicker slide. Those were some historical examples. What's happening here? And this is what I'm trying to get my mind around, and I'm seeing something. I'm connecting the dots, so I apply it to the sacrifice ratio model. Start from the top. Here we have a war in Libya. You have the former president of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi here, and you have the rebel groups. In this case, Gaddafi's individual adaptations were so severe that it hit the sacrifice ratio, and the Libyans were willing to go to war, willing to put themselves in danger, willing to sacrifice themselves for the good of the group. Think about that gentleman standing in front of the Chinese tank. Now think about a country full of those people. That's when the sacrifice ratio gets hit. In Egypt, boy, they were close. Remember that about a year ago? They were in the square. Here's an armored personnel carrier with soldiers ready to fire on these civilians. But it didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Well, those soldiers in those tracks didn't quite hit that sacrifice ratio, in my opinion, did they? They got close. It was ugly. But it wasn't a war. That sacrifice ratio was not met. Going one more down to Tunisia, another in the Arab Springs that happens. We didn't see as much violence. We saw a little bit of a smoother transition because that regime's sacrifice ratio wasn't approached either, and that regime was willing to adapt and move out at a much lower threshold. And you could also make the argument, too, that, you know, here in the United States, we're nowhere near a war, in my opinion, but still, there's a little bit of individualistic adaptation going on in Wall Street. Wouldn't you agree? A little bit. And then there's people who don't like that. So there are forces pushing each other back and forth, that tug of war, if you will. Now, if it gets bad enough where this gets closer to the sacrifice ratio, that would drive violence and under the nature of war theory. In a recent publication, I think it's just this month, the evolutionary biologist, the social biologist, E.O. Wilson, was interviewed and he said something very interesting. We've been talking a lot about this tug of war between individualistic and group, and I've been working this idea for about a year. So that's why I was very shocked, very intrigued when Wilson said, you know, what's up with the human condition? He's talking about two rival forces are driving behavior, group selection and individual selection. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Group selection brings about virtue, and individual selection with it brings about sin. Group selection brings about virtue, individual selection brings about sin. They're in competition. And he said that in a nutshell explains the human condition. This tug of war of two evolutionary biological forces. The nature of war theory takes this framework, this tug of war, and puts down a framework to identify where these forces are originating. Is it individualistic or is it multi-level? Is it group? And if you can identify the origins of those forces, I got to find this. You know which quadrant to put that theory in. So if it's individualistic against individualistic, perhaps we should say, is this a just war? Is this a just war? Is it altruistic against altruistic? This could very well be a just war. If it's irregular, which quadrant are we working in? And if we're down here, we shouldn't be trying to apply Clausewitz. If we're up here, we shouldn't be trying to apply Galula and COIN. The nature of war theory presents this argument, gives a strategic framework approach to identify the forces
that ultimately drive human behavior to go to war and then apply the proper strategy for our nation to either contain or combat these forces.
So that was a lot to cover. My intention was to leave some time for Q&A.
And at this time, yeah, I'm right at 50 minutes where I wanted to be. And I'd love to open up the room for questions. And thank you.
It is now time for the question and answer session. If you do have a question, please indicate so by raising your hand and getting the attention of either Jess or myself, and I will bring the microphone to you. And please wait for the microphone to reach you before asking your questions. Now let's start with the first question.
Well, that tells me one of two things. Okay, good. We got a question. I got to admit to you, before I take this question, thank you. You've been a great audience. This is the debut of this concept. This is the first time I've talked publicly in this complex on this topic. It's hard for me to get my mind around this some days, but I do feel that there's something there. And with the help of this group, and I have my email up there, perhaps you can help me develop this idea some more. So thanks.
Yes, sir. Thanks. Thanks for being so provocative. There are a lot of interesting ideas here. What I'd like to get a feel for is what this framework gets us that more traditional frameworks don't get us. For example, we could talk about asymmetric forms of warfare in terms of, say, colonialism versus indigenous peoples fighting back. What does this give us that those kinds of traditional perspectives?
Thank you. What this gives us is a scientific approach, something that I think theories of war have always lacked, a scientific approach, using the scientific method to look at what's going on here. When you have a scientific method, you have a theory or a hypothesis, then you make your observations and then you test, correct? We all know our scientific method. We never had that with war. So I've got a theory out there. I've got observations. I've developed this something called the sacrifice ratio. And now my next step, which I'll be turning to over the next course of the year, is populating those sacrifice ratios with hard data. And the step that's going to be is going to such watchdog organizations. There are watchdog organizations out there that monitor countries for their level of freedom. And they give them a numerical value for freedom of press, freedom of speech, level of education, level of public services, everything that country is doing for the good of its population. Or, if you will, to back off that sacrifice ratio a bit, get some distance between them. That data is out there. So the step is then to collect that data, which goes back 10 years for such countries like Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Syria, Yemen, plug that into an equation and see if that corresponds to what's going on there. So the mathematics then will give you a predictive tool, a numerical predictive tool, that will say how close is this country going to war, or before we enter another operation overseas as the United States, why don't we take a look at this through some different framework, understanding which quadrant in the nature of war theory we're in, run the numbers, and see what the population's going to do before we venture into this, because I think we understand the individualistic aspects. It's that altruism we need to get our mind around. Scientific approach.
I have a question about one of the examples you used. So you were talking about the war in Iraq, and that's obviously an irregular war, but which force would you consider altruistic and which individualistic?
You're talking the recent war in Iraq,
yes.
OIF-1? Now this is a really telling question. And I will tell you right now that in the nature of war theory, you have to understand natural selection doesn't see good or evil. It sees, you know, that's something we humans do. It sees individualistic and altruistic. So if you moved into Iraq initially
under how we first went into Desert Storm, which was one of the most fantastic, phenomenal land battles of our century. I mean, it was impressive. But something happened afterwards. There was an insurgency that came up from the people. So in that individual, in that respect, we toppled Saddam Hussein. We toppled an individualistic regime, thinking that everything will be good and the world will break out with altruism. My opinion is we didn't understand the full framework of the country. The world didn't break out in altruism because we didn't... I mean, Iraq did not break out in altruism because we didn't understand that group. And you had an insurgency. So in that case, the insurgents in that group were the altruistic groups. And our initial take in Iraq was seen, and our behavior was individualistic. It wasn't until we got a new doctrine that recognized what was going on and allowed us to act altruistically for the good of the group, to win over the population, win hearts and minds, you've heard that phrase? Put that in natural selection. Instead of winning hearts and minds, understanding the altruism of the group. So that is the great change that we saw in our doctrine, from going from an individualistic-based doctrine to one that takes altruism in consideration. So initially individualistic, and then we turned it around in Iraq by turning that into altruism.
Very provocative. Let me throw out a historical example and try to tie into what's going on in Syria, to stay with your looking at the Arab Spring. This guy named Crane Britton wrote a book about the French Revolution, and his theory was that the French Revolution was an example of what he called a revolution of rising expectations. That the reason that as the French people got more, they wanted more, and it eventually leads to the spark, this sacrifice ratios you're talking about. It seems to me that as you start digging this data, that if you look at what's going on in Syria right now, that the lesson may be for leaders of other countries is don't let any freedom show up. Repress as much as you can. Keep people down, because as soon as... some people have interpreted the Arab Spring as what happened is all these totalitarian dictators started to let up a little bit, and once they started to take the... Once the lid came off the pot, they couldn't put it back on, and so you have these explosions. Can you see your research going that way? I mean, in other words, if the sacrifice ratio is an important figure, then the lesson is for repressive regimes: don't let people get a lot of freedom, because you're going to get closer and closer to this explosion.
Yeah, two things on that, Dr. Crane. Thanks for your question. It does get complex. The point's really well taken. If you're a leader, whether you're a democratic or autocrat or whatever, you better understand how much your population can take. And some population sacrifice ratios will be less or more than others. So that's the first thing, is identifying where that sacrifice ratio is, a very critical aspect of it. But the other aspect goes back to natural selection. Natural selection, in my opinion, exists. It is. Adaptation happens because if adaptation doesn't happen, extinction happens. And extinction is not good for a species. So although you might have an individualistic regime that continually oppresses, you're going to see adaptations chink away at that. And that adaptation might be the use of social media, for example. They never had that ability in Egypt. They realized it was out there, and it was an adaptation that group did that allowed them to compete with the individualistic. There are other examples of that. You go back in history, and you think about any group that had a technological... What is it? What, necessity drives invention. I think that's it. You can also say that evolution drives invention, too, because you have to adapt or go extinct. So, yes, the individual regime leader must know where that population sacrifice ratio is, and it's less for others than it is for some. But don't ever think that a prudent leader wouldn't ever think that his population would not be capable of adapting, because it happens in nature. So I'm...
Thank you. Most interesting. Have you given thought to applying this theory to other disciplines? What came to my mind was economics and economic theory, and Greece in particular, as it was exposé this morning on NPR, with regard to the number of people who just ignore paying their taxes, how the railroads cost $400 million to maintain, but it only takes in $100 million. It's cheaper to put everybody in a taxi, but the state wants to keep government workers employed. Other disciplines like economics to apply this?
Yes, sir, I have. And boy, this, if you're seeing that connection, that's encouraging me, because I think there is a connection that goes well beyond war on this. If you take a look at and I'm not a sociologist, but thinking back to Packers Lions, if you have too many people in a group that are not behaving altruistically, that group is not sustainable. So then you have to kind of look at that from a social economic, from a welfare aspect, from a whole bunch of other things, and take a look at the right balance that needs to be taken from approaching this dynamic from an individualistic, altruistic balance. I'm struggling with this one, but the answer is yes. And if you take Wilson's tug of war between individualistic and altruistic back and forth, if you have too much of one or too much of the other, it doesn't matter if it's war, it's still behavior. And that behavior can be economic, it can be social, it can be scientific even. So yes, I think it does apply. Anywhere where there's a human behavior could apply.
You have time for one more question?
Yeah, I've got them.
Okay. So I noticed that you're, to some extent, assimilating cases that I would think of as being civil war with cases of interstate war. And it would seem to me that one obvious difficulty in formulating this is that the question of what the group is that one can be altruistic for is going to be very difficult to demarcate, or you're going to have to demarcate it differently in those situations. So in wars between two different states, or even, say, the Iraq war, you ended up with three groups, right?
There was
Saddam Hussein, the U.S. Army, and the Iraqi insurgents, and maybe more. So when someone's acting altruistically, you first have to ask which group interest are they trying to defend. It's not the interest of humanity as a whole, right? It's an interest of a particular subgroup,
yes,
like with the Lions. And it seems to me that that's also going to be an issue if you try and extend it into economic behavior.
That is why Wilson argues that evolution happens at multiple group levels. So the hardest thing to do here is define the group. You're absolutely right. Is it a nation state? Is it a subgroup? Is it an individual people? Or, as I heard at lunch, maybe it's a group of cells in our own body that are doing our own thing as its group. It's a very interesting discussion. What drives the group? But I think war is a phenomenon that focuses on specific groups. You either have what we call Westphalian state groups, which are groups as we know because they're represented by countries with capitals, or they're groups represented by non-state actors that are still groups, al-Qaeda, if you will. So the nature of war theory sticks to those groups that we recognize as being warlike groups.
So to take the French Revolution for an example, right? It would seem to me that there's, at least in, say, the 1830 or 1848, you've got old monarchist elements, and you're seeing it as, it seems to me that you're defining it as though there's just the people who are being oppressed, and then there's a monarchy oppressing them, and maybe the nobles with the monarchy. But there's actually at least four groups. There's the monarchy, there's all other nobility that isn't quite aligned with the monarch, and then it's like, as you say, if you read in the Communist Manifesto, there's then the workers and bourgeoisie, rising bourgeoisie. So it's not obvious which groups are going to align with each other in that type of interstate war. And it might be somewhat more obvious in an international war.
The trick to that, under the theory, the trick to that is the coercion of altruistic values, getting the altruistic values, the majority of altruistic values, on your side of the fight. So you have, very simply, the monarchy taking privations on the peasantry. But you've also got a whole bunch of people who don't care, right? They're in the middle.
They're just hoping to get food on their table, whatever. The ability to coerce them to one group or the other, and to coerce their altruism, that's the key component in this too, if you're following that. So the Civil War, I use that as altruistic against altruistic, but my own self-criticism in that, if you take a look at the sources of the Civil War, many of them were very individualistic. I'll cite slavery, for example. But somehow or other, we co-opted an entire force for the South to act altruistically. Was it an altruistic war? I'm not sure, but we were able to co-opt that. And that's the key of counterinsurgency doctrine, is to get the people in the area on your side, to coerce their altruism to say that your way is for the good of the group. And that's the Iraq model that was asked earlier.
Hi, thank you for coming. Really provocative. Taken as a given that your theory is correct and works very well, do you think, with human societies being as complicated as they are, do you think that any amount of data will ever enable you to actually predict results to any degree of accuracy and how this will turn out in the future?
Yeah, that's a good question and one I think about a lot. I don't think there's going to be a magic algorithm here. You're going to be able to plug in a computer and say, should the United States exert its military arm here, and what will happen? What I'm hoping for is a theory that will be available to those of us at the national strategic level, that before we enter into a scenario that where we're putting our forces or our coalition's forces in a harm's way, we know what we're getting into, and because we know the evolutionary forces at play. And if we know that, then we know the proper doctrine, and we know the proper objective. And you know what? We can even put a price tag on it too, somewhat, because counterinsurgency is really expensive. They think that it might sound like counterinsurgency is cheap, put some people down on the ground, win hearts and minds, but it's darned expensive. So if someone says, you know, let's take a look at country X and do a counterinsurgency in there, on the surface it doesn't sound expensive because there's not a lot of tanks and there's not a lot of airplanes and stuff, but it is darned expensive, and I think our strategists need to know that. So that's what I'm looking for in this model, is somewhat of a predictive value in the sacrifice ratio. Will what we're doing lead to war? Where are those sacrifice ratios? But really a different way of looking at national strategy that frames the environment that we're going into, that takes the existence of the group that's there in the first place, their altruistic motives, in consideration before we try to affect national strategy.
I have a question, if you don't mind, over here.
Oh, sure.
Kind of going off of what he said, do you feel like, either personally or have you been working on it, whether the individual side or the altruism side has more of a tendency to win out in an irregular war?
Ooh, good question. In fact, I promise I wouldn't do this, but Dr. Crane, I think the statistics say in counterinsurgencies, that's where an individualistic force is trying to win over an altruistic force. What's the track record on that historically?
It depends. The problem is because the results are so murky.
Yeah. Well, it's good. I mean, there's a lot of fuzzy math there, and you know what? I'm not sure, because I haven't gone down that yet. Like I said, I've got my theory, I've got my hypothesis. I'm making observations now, and next in the scientific method is to make those measurements. But I will take a line out of Thucydides in his Peloponnesian War that might answer your question, where he says the strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must. So if you're on the stronger side and you've got all the toys, you're going to win, unless the weak has got an upgrowth of altruism that blossoms like we saw in the American Civil War. It doesn't happen all the time. Remember, nature isn't good or evil. It just is.
Hi. Thank you for the talk. The very interesting theory. I'm interested about the comments you just made about individualistic goals co-opting the language and the means of altruism. And I'm interested in how maybe the concept of the nation state fits into that framework, in that, you know, a nation state is supposedly an altruistic device that acts for the good of all, you know, Americans, say, but often acts for individualistic means because it acts as an individual nation state. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this idea of a nation state, what we call Westphalian state, which means it's a country with a capital and you know, some sort of rulers. We can put it on an atlas. And then I started thinking, if you're not one of those guys who's enjoying the organization, the efficiencies, and everything that comes with a nation state, if you're not one of those, what choices do you have? You can either adapt or go extinct. So what the nature of war, one of the insights of this theory is, what we're seeing with the non-state actors is an adaptation, saying, well, we can't compete with you as a Westphalian nation state, so we're going to turn into something else. We are adapting to something that's borderless, something without a leader, something that's developing, it's adapting by itself through a natural altruistic response, if you remember, not good or evil, altruistic response to compete out of something or else you go extinct. So that's the way I tie in this idea of the nation state, and that's when I think about the nation state, that perhaps the human species might be forming the next group, another group, that doesn't need borders, that doesn't need a central government, in order to compete, come out of the rain, if you will, and compete on the world stage. And that's what you know, we might be, there are indications we could possibly be seeing something like that, fueled by the internet.
Well, now, if you will, could you please give us some final thoughts?
I have a couple closing remarks. Yes. Oh, good. Okay. This is a slide that I want to put up. That it's actually a thank you slide too, because I think it pulls a lot of what I'm talking about together. I've used a lot of terms: biology, evolution, altruism. But the more I think through the theory of war and natural selection and apply that to war, some of these words mean the same thing. They're just different words. So I think about honor. And I think about doing the right thing for the good of the group, even though you're putting yourself at a sacrifice. And I look at that soldier, that Marine there in Afghanistan, and his buddy. You can't really see his buddy, but both of them are being human shields to protect those civilians. The idea there is you're trying to understand the altruism of a group. And what better way to understand the altruism of a group who they're sacrificing themselves for the good of the group, for you too to sacrifice yourself, for these soldiers to put their welfare and their fitness in the line of fire for the good of the group. I see this, and I think our soldiers get this. When you see them going to their third, fourth, fifth deployment in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're in situations like this, they get it. And I'd ask you that when you see these soldiers and you thank them for their service, understand what you're thanking them for, and I think you all do. You're understanding them, you're thanking them for doing this, being altruistic, honorable, but I think you're also thanking them for what they're doing for our group. Because the fact is, what you are doing here at Dickinson University is enormously important to this group. You're in the libraries, you're studying, you're taking care of families, you're dedicating yourself to something greater than just staying at home and taking individual privations. The fact is, you're here tonight with me shows that you want to be here and not be doing something at home which just benefits you. So the fact that they're out here doing that, they're defending the fact that you're here making our country stronger, more educated,
moving forward. So thank them for their service. But you know what they'll say? They want to thank you for allowing them to do their service too, because we're all in the same group. So as I close, I think that we are the land of the free because of the altruistic, I mean the brave. Thank you.
Thank you for calling me. Have a good night.